Israel saying it will flood Gaza with humanitarian aid, a growing rift between Biden and Netanyahu. Zone of Interest, executive producer, telling us on Unholy this week why he strongly disagrees with Jonathan Glazer's speech. And we hear about a little known story about an alternative Zion in Texas. It's Unholy. I'm Yanit Levy of Channel 12 in Tel Aviv.
And I'm Jonathan Friedland of The Guardian in London. Unholy, two Jews on the news. In a way, this week, Yoni, a slight sort of hint of what life was like before 5 months ago, when we would quite often have sort of cultural figures on the podcast. This week, we're allowing some of that light back in. Interviews coming up with two really interesting people, Rachel Cockrell, the writer, and Danny Cohen, movie producer. And yet, of course, Danny Cohen is going to be a more newsy, timely guest than probably either he or we anticipated. We'll come on to all of that. But actual news...
There's no just culture stories anymore, right? No, it always has to connect somehow with current events and what's going on.
Yeah, and the Oscars was... You know, I know there were people who was putting on the Oscars as a form of escapism. There were people who said, you know, I've been doing news for 5 months. I'm just going to put my feet up, watch the Oscars. It's going to be Barbie and a bit of glamour, and I'm going to take my mind off everything. And in a way, this was almost, you know, the point always of Jonathan Glazer's intervention, I think, was to say, no, it, you know, you can't look away. Anyway, people couldn't look away. We also can't do that because the news keeps going and this war is ongoing. So we should have a bit of an update on all of that.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the word, the operative word here is stuck. It's mid-March, more than 5 months in. The strategy, sort of unannounced, but pretty clear on the Israeli side, or particularly maybe the American side, was to say, we're going to have some sort of ceasefire. It's going to be prolonged. It's going to be for 45 days. We're going to get 45 hostages out of the 134 Israeli hostages still held by Hamas. That relative, you know, pause or long cessation in military activities will allow us to also realize or try and achieve a diplomatic solution in the north. I remind you, there are at least more than 100,000 Israelis displaced in the north because of the conflict with Hezbollah that has been flaring up as well. But until there is a deal, all of this hinges upon that, and all sides are still stuck in this situation.
And this feeling of stuckness, I have to say, there's an element of this that just baffles me, which is, there has been continual sustained American pressure for weeks, in fact, for months, urging the government to do this deal, we'll get on to talking about aid later, but also to, you know, take greater care over civilian losses and so on. The rhetoric from Washington has ratcheted up and up and up. Big statement last week from the vice president, and yet nothing changes. And, you know, all the kind of old handbooks that used to talk about, well, of course, if the Americans lean on Israel, if they really lean on them, then, of course, Israel would have to change course. No pressure seems to make any difference at all to this government. I mean, people speculate why that is, whether actually Netanyahu is in no hurry to do favors for Joe Biden, because he knows Gaza is a huge political headache for Joe Biden domestically with his own Democratic Party, his coalition, younger voters, progressives. And he actually wants Biden gone and would quite like to see Donald Trump back, although no love lost there either. I don't know, but I know there is great frustration in Washington about Netanyahu and about the government. And it's...
You're definitely right about that. They want the war to be over. That's for sure. They want the war over. And Netanyahu, and there are a lot of Israelis who don't want the war to be over for two reasons. A, we want our hostages back. And B, we think, the Israelis think there isn't enough achievements against Hamas in this war. It's definitely, that is the crux of the argument. The Americans want the war to be over. Netanyahu and a large part of the Israeli public think that the war should continue, first and foremost, to get the Israeli hostages out, and secondly, because there need to be more achievements in this war against Hamas. We are seeing, obviously, a growing...
I'm just going to jump in with one thing, just on that point about to get the hostages out. Of course, you hear the hostage families, some of them, saying that they feel the war continuing endangers the lives of the hostages, and the best way to get them out is to stop the fighting, get them out, and then you can make a judgment in a few weeks' time. So just put adding that as a sort of just an addendum on that point about what, you know, what is the best way of getting the hostages. That opinion is divided on that, and the hostage family is obviously very vocal on that point.
Right. That's completely accurate. And of course, what we're seeing this week, when the president of the United States is saying in an interview to MSNBC that the Israeli leader is hurting Israel, and also an American intelligence report coming out saying that Netanyahu's viability to lead Israel is in jeopardy, a response to that in Israel, official and non-official. So officially, Netanyahu is saying most of Israelis support me. We'll get on to that in a minute when we talk about the recent opinion polls. And also a senior Israeli official, I'll let you guess who that is saying the United States should be working at toppling Hamas and not toppling the elected Israeli government. So we are definitely seeing a new low here. You mentioned the question of Trump. There have been these murmurs, let's say, inside the Israeli government, not from Netanyahu's quarters, that are saying, yes, Netanyahu is putting his investments again on the option of a Donald Trump presidency, and that is felt in Washington as well. We are definitely in a situation where, by the way, both sides politically stand to gain from this, right? Netanyahu saying things against Biden and Biden saying things against Netanyahu. The only difference is, of course, that Israel does need the United States in this more than the United States needs Israel.
Yes, and it hurts Israel. You know, it was always believed as a truism that the relationship with the United States was Israel's number one and most critical strategic asset. And Netanyahu has repeatedly jeopardized it and messed with it. I think on the assumption that the Americans would never, ever leave, that they'll always be at Israel's side. And I think that is a very shaky assumption. You can think these things are forever until suddenly they're not. And he's messed with it. But I do go back to this point about the pressure. It's of note to me. It goes, you know, it's become unfashionable to talk about Netanyahu as the great magician, the sorcerer, that he just, you know, politically the great survivor, because everyone has been writing his political obituary since October the 7th. And yet I do note that he's got the war cabinet, which buttresses him. Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot, lots of talk about when they're going to go. They're still there. They haven't gone. And Biden is still sending the ammunition that somehow they can make the noises and issue the statements and increase the rhetoric, but one way or another, he's still there, and he just goes on and on and on. And I don't know quite what it's going to take, because the usual levers, people are pulling them, they're not working. But we'll see. I mean, you know, and you told us a couple of weeks ago about the time bomb that Gallant had put under the coalition, the defense minister, with, you know, the army service draft bill and so on. Maybe. But right now, and you're perhaps hearing the kind of frustration in my voice, I don't know what it takes to I don't know what it takes to move this guy and to get him to do what all this pressure would say he would have to do. He doesn't seem to crack.
Well, the polls have been very consistent in the way in which we talked about this, but also the recent poll that My Network published this week. Same sort of sentiment. Israeli public moving to the right because of the war, but it is not moving towards Benjamin Netanyahu. And this continues. His party now in the polls, Likud, the party he leads, is at 19 seats. He's tanking in the polls. So that is pretty clear. And we are looking at what we assume will be early elections this year.
Yeah. And all that does, I think, is make him even more incentivized and motivated to stay longer, because, elections do look gloomy for him. So, as I say, he's got no incentive to go and every incentive to stay. And so far, he seems to be able to hold on. I said we'd get on to talking about aid. That has absolutely become the point of tension between Israel and its allies, and I would say in terms of world opinion and debate about Israel. Now, the images that you see out of Gaza are not images of war. They're not even the images that we saw in the first phase, which was, you know, destroyed buildings and grieving relatives holding the bodies of their loved ones. They are now the images you would associate with seeing a famine. Pictures of children with, you know, shrunken limbs, malnourished children. Those are the images that are on front pages around the world. I have, been growing in despair about this as it's been going on. We had on the podcast a while back Michael Walzer, the moral philosopher, author of Just War and Just War Theory, really. He made that distinction between jus ad bellum and jus or jus in bello, meaning the justice of going to war and the justice of how you conduct the war. And it seems to me that this has gone directly to Israel's claim to be fighting a war which many, many people were ready to accept was just. You had to hit back after October 7th and do what you could to degrade Hamas. But fighting that just war unjustly by denying or slow walking or restricting aid as it goes in. I have been baffled by it because I think, why would you do that if you are trying to keep, for all kinds of reasons, why would you do that? Why would you allow those images to be around the world of starving children in Gaza? It has united much of the world against Israel, including deep conviction allies of Israel. That's who the people I've been listening to most, people who have been with Israel every step of the way, including in this conflict, just cannot defend this. And you hear that in the Joe Biden and Kamala Harris talk about enough with the excuses, just do it. But you hear it from, you know, other governments around the world. It is massively given, I think, fuel to those at the International Court of Justice who want to press the genocide case against Israel. Remember that court passed two of those measures. One was about incitement. The other one was you have to let humanitarian aid through. Even Israel's own ad hoc Justice Aharon Barak voted for that one. So that danger that Israel could be found in violation of those provisional measures. And above all, it seems to me, this is such a departure from, violation of, Jewish values. I want to quote Ishai Rosenzvi, who's a chair of the Department for Jewish Philosophy and Talmud at Tel Aviv University, who wrote this week, "This is not an authentic expression of Jewish tradition." He was talking more generally, but this is not an authentic expression of Jewish tradition, but rather a new type of Judaism, one that glorifies power and scorns the weak and needy. It is a reversal of the Jewish tradition I have dedicated my life to learning and teaching. Now, we hope that this week we had Daniel Hagari, the spokesman, IDF spokesman, saying there's going to be a change in policy. As you said, we're going to flood Gaza with aid. I note that it wasn't the government saying that, it was the IDF. I note it was saying it to the foreign media rather than to Israel itself. So we'll wait and see if this is made, if this happens. But maybe that's an admission that what's happened until now has been the most terrible, calamitous mistake for Israel's own reputation and its standing with allies and friends. And I would say, morally, it's just been a terrible thing to have done when you're telling people you're fighting your enemy as Hamas, to instead be inflicting this suffering on the people of Gaza.
So I have to first say that the pictures coming out of Gaza are heartbreaking, and the situation is heartbreaking. There is no doubt that it's a human tragedy, and that we Israelis need to remember that we are right on the moral level, and that means that we can't lose our humanity. I think that is, up until now, we are in agreement. From now on, we are in complete departure. Because what you're saying, essentially, without saying it, is that Israel is doing this deliberately, that it is knowingly making children starve, it's denying, and it's restricting. Those are the words you use. Now, let's kind of backtrack that a little bit. It is very clear. And I know this from the conversations inside the IDF. I know this because I've followed this carefully with the military officials who have been dealing with this for weeks and months, and with the civil Israeli part of this conversation that have a professional knowledge in aid. It is very clear that Israel knows morally what the right thing to do is here. And it's clear that there's one part of the story that doesn't want to starve the population, which is Israel, and the other side that only benefits from that kind of picture, and that is Hamas. We should maybe help our listeners with a little bit of data here. It's not a coincidence. We're talking specifically about a dire situation in the northern part of the Gaza Strip, which is more under the control of Israel than the southern part, and something around the 100,000, 150,000 Palestinians still there. These are not independent contracting looters. There's no coincidence that there has been looting. It's very clear that Hamas is the party behind that. But before even getting into that, Israel is, again, could Israel have done more? Possibly and probably. Is there a problem of chaos of war, first and foremost, and then, I'm sorry to say, probably ineptitude in running this whole operation? Probably. But when you look at what is being done, right, first of all, the trucks, which I apologize to the airdrops, right? But the main way to get aid into Gaza is trucks. Egypt is getting paid for every truck coming in. So you see this slowing down of the process that it has to go through. Israel checking it at Kerem Shalom, which is the Israeli side of the crossing, and then going into Egypt and checking it again. This is slow. It isn't slow because someone wants to starve the population. It's slow because it's slow. If you have a situation of war in which one of the leaders of the Houthis is today saying, listen, guys, to all of the Arab enemies of Israel, when you do the airdrops, make sure that there's ammunition dropped on because Israel's not checking that, then you understand why Israel's being, you know, pretty careful and circumspect in checking the aid coming in through Rafah. You have now the issue of the floating pier that the Americans are setting up. This is all in coordination with Israel. Israel's going to be the one securing this. So it is not a problem of, at the end of the day, of the amount of food. It's a problem of distribution. And distribution of food will determine who rules Gaza. I think the problem Israel has is the fact that it didn't decide, and that is also problematic, who will be the element that will take care of distribution. We published an argument between Defense Minister Yoav Gallant and Netanyahu. Yoav Gallant saying, someone needs to be taking care of the distribution of the aid. If it's not going to be Hamas, it has to be Fatah. Netanyahu refusing it to be Fatah. And Yoav Gallant responding with, there are no Swedes in Gaza. So I think a lot of it is in the details. But if at the end of the day, you don't, not you, the world doesn't believe that Israel's intention, morally, legally, and from a strategic standpoint even, right, is not to starve the population, then it's a very hard case to be making.
Yeah, well, the world doesn't believe that. So that's, you know, that is the problem. And I think partly why they don't believe it, just to state the obvious, if IDF spokesman Daniel Hagari is announcing a change in policy, what was called described as a dramatic pivot, now we're going to get lots of aid in, that tells you there was previously some kind of situation where they were not getting lots of aid in. So if he was, if there was no change, if this wasn't all on Israel, let me just come back on a couple of these things and then.
Just a sec, the correction that he made, what he said was essentially the ideology is now saying, if we have a problem in distribution, we can't fix that problem, so we'll flood. Now we realize what we need to do is to flood the area so the distribution problem might solve itself. That is the change. You're right in the sense that when he says it's a flood, maybe mistakes have been made, but there's a difference between thinking the mistake came out of malice and the mistake came out of incompetence. Okay. That is where we differ.
I understand. And the thing is, what I wouldn't say is, this was a high-level, total, all-state policy to starve Gazans. Of course, I don't think that. I rather think there's all different players here. There's an absence of overall strategy, and I think people who are really close to this say that. Instead, you've got the IDF doing one thing, you've got politicians doing another thing, the cabinet itself divided. We know that, you know, Ben-Gvir, the bits he controls, he tries to, you know, you had that situation at the border, the crossing, where vis-a-vis demonstrators who were trying to stop aid getting in. So I think it's a mess. But on your point, for example, about the checking of aid supplies, of course there have to be checks. But when you are going through six loading and unloading processes, so all supplies unloaded from Egyptian trucks go into sterile trucks, they are then taken to a checkpoint where the contents are unloaded again for detailed inspection if they pass. And if only one item is rejected by all Israeli authorities, the whole truck is then sent back. Then they have to be loaded again onto sterile trucks, taken to the Gaza border, unloaded again and reloaded onto trucks, etc. That's an account of what happens there. You do get the sense that there is not a huge urgency and desire. That's really my point. If Israel was convinced from the beginning, we have to make clear to the people of Gaza, our war is with Hamas, not Gaza, you would be the full focus of the IDF and the sort of state machinery would be on ensuring what apparently, I hope, please God, is going to happen now, which is it is a strategic priority to make sure that we are not in any way guilty of or blamed abroad for the starving of the people of Gaza. We will flood the zone from the beginning. That wasn't a strategic priority. Instead, this has been what's allowed to happen. And now, 5 months in, I think it's an acknowledgement that they made a mistake there in allowing this to be run the way it has been.
Even if you, not you, Jonathan, you, the world, think Israel wants, right, wants the vengeance on these on Palestinian children, if you even if that's what you think, Israel strategically understands that this is the wrong way to go. Even I argue that Israel morally understands this as well. It's strategically wrong because it would stop the war. So it is doing what it can, again, now opening a big road, sort of a highway, road 96 to bring in aid from the north. Listen, we are analyzing the mistakes Israel made. And by the way, it made mistakes in humanitarian aid. You know, we have talked about this. You have talked about this. I agree that Israel has made mistakes. But they're mistakes that you have to add on to chaos of war, bureaucracy, inexperience on how to bring aid to a population in the middle of a war when you're still fighting this terrible enemy, and not because this is the malice and the evilness of a country trying to starve another population. That is something I will never agree to because I think it's totally wrong.
Well, I think, just maybe we'll close this with this, but I think the accusation that it was, you know, a malice and starvation, no. But the idea that this was a sanction that would increase pressure on Hamas in the way that countries have done sanctions, the West did it on Iraq for years. I think that was, among some parts of the decision makers, a tactic. And when you say mistakes were made, that sounds like putting the wrong, you know, use-by date on a crate of food. This was a strategic error not to understand from the beginning. We talked about it, you and I, in similarly spirited terms, right at the beginning. This had to be a priority. The idea that we're inexperienced, we don't know. From the beginning, it needed to be understood, whatever else happens, there must be a flood of food and medicine. That a very senior American general I spoke to months ago said exactly this. A flood of food and medicine so the people are clear. The people fighting us are not fighting us Gazans, they are fighting Hamas. Instead, strategic error, not just mistakes were made, strategic error not to realize that. I think 5 months late, Israeli decision makers have clocked that now, and that's why we get the Daniel Hagari statement. But I don't think there was that understanding, which is not the same as saying it's a malicious desire to starve the whole population. One way or another, you and I, Yonit, are going to keep going round and round this circuit, I think. We have talked about that a lot from the start, and we will continue. We mentioned at the top, though, that the Oscars proved to be a huge talking point in this area. And it was because of a speech that really did go round the world. It was by Jonathan Glazer, director of the Zone of Interest. And it's short enough to hear the relevant bit. We can do that now.
Our film shows where dehumanization leads at its worst. It shaped all of our past and present. Right now, we stand here as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people. Whether the victims of October the... Whether the victims of October the 7th in Israel or the ongoing attack on Gaza, all are victims of this dehumanization. How do we resist? Alexandra Bistron Kaladze-Hchek, the girl who glows in the film as she did in life, chose to. I dedicate this to her memory and her resistance. Thank you.
I mean, the thing that leapt out at me at that first, you know, call me a pedant, it's just so poorly worded. It's really surprising coming from a writer and sort of artist, because he says we refute our Jewishness, and of course he then goes on to say being used by X, Y, and Z, but people heard those four words and immediately either condemned or embraced them, depending where they were coming from. It was just a bit of ambiguous wording on his part, so that was, you know, my first and obviously minor point. But the rest of it, you know, it has split people very badly and revealed a lot. What did you think?
You know, I wasn't as upset before I saw his film. And after seeing his film, I'm more upset because someone so talented in nuances and sensitivities and layering and, you know, deep thinking, like the man who made this wonderful film, to then so clumsily word what he was trying to say is just unforgivable. I mean, just on that level, there's been a lot of discussion. Did he mean refute his Jewishness, or did he mean that his Jewishness is hijacked and he doesn't like, whatever, it doesn't matter. The way that he began what he was saying, carefully, by the way, he was holding a piece of paper. And whatever you think of the conflict, who you blame for it, obviously, if you listen to what he said, the occupation is to blame for everything, including October 7th. Even if that's what you think, don't you care about the fact that there are students being attacked on campuses, children being attacked in schools, anti-Semitism everywhere, and beginning what you say with the words, "We refute our Jewishness." Just that. And the other thing, you know, just the sadness of, you know, as an Israeli, to think of the fact that this is the most mainstream ceremonial event in America. This is a director of an important film, and he's standing on stage saying, you know, a narrative that most Israelis vehemently would disagree with, and he's getting applauded. That is something that, you know, makes me, you know, sad on that level. I can go on and on, but those are my, you know, that's my initial thinking about this.
Yes. I mean, I too balked at the implication that all of this is just as a result of occupation. And I think what we know about Hamas is their issue isn't just the occupation. Their issue is Israel's own very existence. I also thought that there's no other way of reading it than he inevitably isn't just saying, let's give him the benefit of the doubt about the wording and say he just, you know, let's go to his wider point. He makes a strong point in saying that this film is not only about the past, it's about the present, that people are able to turn a blind eye to horrors, not just in the 1940s, but now. Fair enough. But that's a wider point about the world. Inevitably, because of the way he framed it, it was seen as being only and applying to Gaza and Israel. And that is a huge problem, because then by doing that, whether he wants to or not, he has equated what Israel is doing in Gaza to the Holocaust. And that is, you know, we've got both of us very strong feelings about that. That is not right. That is not a right thing to do. It's not a merited comparison. I mean, it's ridiculous that we even have to do this, but in terms of scale, obviously, the death toll in Gaza, appalling as it is the equivalent of 2 days at Auschwitz, which was one of five dedicated, even six, depending on how you count, dedicated death factories. So to compare the two just in scale, but also obviously Israel is responding to a threat from Hamas on October the 7th, an attack. There was no equivalent threat by the Jews against the Germans, and on and on and on. So in other words, if he had made his point about the way we ignore catastrophic suffering in Ukraine or in Syria or now in Sudan. And yes, if he wants to throw in the Middle East, if he wants to, he can do that. But he didn't do that. He framed it very specifically about Gaza. And it did play into this fear that a lot of people have, that the world is dividing us up now into the good Jews who do what he did and the rest. That's why we refute our Jewishness, albeit a misspeak, has really played into that, because it sounded like the vibe of it was, I'm standing here before you as someone who repudiates my fellow Jews, and I'm with all of you. Loud applause. I found it all a troubling episode, really. The reactions to it, the errors, the misunderstandings, all of it. But as it happens, our guest this week is somebody who could not be better placed to talk about this. He's directly involved in the film. Let's hear from him.
Dan, Danny Cohen is the executive producer of Zone of Interest, the Holocaust film that won an Oscar this week for Best International Film and Best Sound. He is the president of Access Entertainment, where he invests in film, television, live theater, digital content, and immersive art. He was previously the director of BBC Television. He's also a dear friend, so we're very, very delighted to have him on Unholy. Danny, thank you for talking to us today.
Thank you, Yoni. Thank you, Jonathan. Really happy to. Fan of the podcast. And a lot of respect for you both.
Oh. And it really is mutual, and we're really glad you're on today. We want to talk particularly about the film, which is remarkable, and about your views on the BBC. But we have to talk about the speech. You weren't on stage when director Jonathan Glazer made the remarks that went around the world. I do wonder if it surprised you, and if you could tell us your reaction to what you heard.
Yeah, sure. So, and I think it makes sense to have a reaction. I've been, writing and commenting a lot about what's happened since the 7th of October, anti-Semitism in the UK and so on. So, I'm really happy to. So, two or three things, I think. First of all, I think it's really important to recognize it's upset a lot of people, and a lot of people feel upset and angry about it. And I understand that anger. Frankly, I think a lot of people felt that it was a moment. Well, a lot of people in the Jewish community that have contacted me felt that it was, A, they think it's a remarkable and very, very important film. And in being so, tells the story of the Holocaust and forms a very, very important piece of Holocaust education. And I think they've been upset by the sense that they feel that that has been mixed up with what's going on now, whether that was Jonathan's intention or not to do that. And I really understand that. The second thing is I just fundamentally disagree with Jonathan on this. My support for Israel is unwavering. I believe very strongly that the war and the continuation of the war is the responsibility of Hamas, a genocidal terrorist organization, which continues to hold and abuse the hostages and which doesn't use its tunnels to protect the innocent civilians of Gaza, but uses it to hide themselves and allow Palestinians to die. I think the war is tragic and awful, and the loss of civilian life is awful, but I blame Hamas for that. And I think any discussion of the war without saying that is, for me, lacks the proper context that any discussion of that war, from my perspective, should have. And the third thing I feel just personally is I think it's been a huge distraction from the film itself. You know, the film is an extraordinary triumph of filmmaking. I truly think, and I say this with dedication to the team involved, not myself, that it's one of the most remarkable films in decades, one of the truly great films about the Holocaust, and it will survive as such for decades. And the discussion this week and this moment of great recognition for the film with two Academy Awards is not about the film, but it's about the speech. Mm-hmm. And, John spent 10 years making the film and has made something remarkable, but people are talking more this week about what he said for 30 seconds. And I think that's regrettable because I'd love just the conversation to be focused on the film itself. So John has the right to say what he wants to say, but, I don't agree with what he said. And I'm frustrated that it's been a distraction this week.
I'm interested to know whether he talked about it in advance with anybody, given the strong feelings you've described, or whether he just did this on his own. I mean, directors can do things on their own, I suppose.
My understanding is he did it with Jim Wilson. You know, Jim has been he's the producer of the film, did an extraordinary job on the film. Great credit for the quality of the film rests with Jim alongside John and everyone else involved. But they've been collaborators on filmmaking and in life and in ideas for a long time. So I believe it's something they wrote together.
I mean, obviously it was very clumsily worded. And this thing, because the clip and the quote that everyone took out was, I refute, or as men who refute their Jewishness.
Yeah.
And everyone just heard those words. And then he says, and the Holocaust being hijacked. So he meant the Jewishness was being refuted, but it sounded like he was sort of renouncing his Jewish identity. But he did then go on to say that the Holocaust is, well, his word was hijacked. Do you tell me whether you think there's even a kernel of a legitimate argument in that, in the sense that people do sometimes in Israel invoke the Holocaust as a reason why this or that course of action is justified. People say, never again are we going to face a genocidal threat. Now it's Hamas. It used to be the not.
Yeah.
Is he completely wrong? I'm agreeing with you about the wording and the clumsiness.
Yeah.
But is he completely wrong?
I don't think he is. I think there is some truth in it. Listen, it's his film. He can stand up there and choose his own words, and that's fine. And he'll do that. And he's a strong person, and I'm sure he'll stand by those. But for me, it wasn't the right time and didn't have enough context. And I thought it was a distraction from the great piece of art. You know, John is someone who really, he allows his work to do the talking. I mean, that's one of the magnificent things. And actually, I've had some very interesting debates he's had with people about the film. So for example, and sorry if there's any spoilers in this, but you know, I've heard people ask him, well, what does it mean when Hoss is sick at the end of the film? And John's response to that, and I think it's rather interesting, is well, he just says, well, what do you think? He's not actually that interested in telling people what he thinks a literal way about them. He wants people to experience the film and come to their own views on meaning in it, in its various detail and contexts. So I'm much more in favor of the film doing the talking than what you can say on, you know, on TV in 30 seconds in a heated environment.
So let's talk about the film. You called it a triumph of filmmaking. I think that's accurate. It's powerful and it's subtle and it's brilliant. I saw it today, so I'm still sort of under the effect of it. To anyone who doesn't know, we'll just say it's the domestic life of Rudolf Hess's family. He was the commandant of Auschwitz, and it's seemingly this normal life that is really sharing a wall with Auschwitz and the death camp. You don't see... we should say, I hope I'm not ruining this for you. You don't see anything, but you hear a lot. And the sound is really a character in the film. And I think, you know, rightfully so, deserved an Oscar. I'm wondering what you, having worked on this for so many years, I've heard you personally talk about it for such a long time. What do you hope people take from this? What do they need to feel about it? What do they need to learn about it?
Yeah. So... I mean, there are so many things. I think the film is a physical and visceral experience. And
it really is.
Having watched, I don't know, many, many cuts and read many different versions of the scripts, I was actually surprised when I saw it for the first time on a large screen with the sound, which was actually at the Cannes Film Festival where it won the Grand Prix, at how physically taut you feel when you're watching it. Mm-hmm. And I think that tells you that that the film that John has made and the way he's made it takes you to the heart of something very frightening and very evil. And it reminds you of how frightening and evil the Holocaust was. People talk a lot about the banality of evil, and I agree that's in the film. I mean, it's a very, very important part of the film. But actually, that growing sense of menace and that growing sense of threat that you get through sound as much as picture... And the collaboration within the film of sound and picture with sort of domestic scenes, I think tells you about the extremity of the Holocaust, its viciousness, its uniqueness, the callousness of the criminals who committed it. And it tells you a lot about anti-Semitism. You know, there's a huge amount in that film which is about anti-Semitism, that extraordinary scene in the garden where Hoss's wife, Hedwig, is talking to her mother, and she's talking about, you know, she didn't get the curtains from the Jewish family and, you know, Jewish stuff and all of those things she says. I mean, there's a huge amount of it about anti-Semitism, which I think, you know, I've not seen anything like it in the way it can transfer that without saying very much. I mean, it's very taut, the script, in many ways. So I think it tells you about the unique horror of the Holocaust. I think it tells you a lot about anti-Semitism. I think it tells you some things. It requires on some levels a knowledge of the Holocaust so that, you know, some viewers will get that, some won't. When you know, the film references things like Canada, there are moments like that, or, you know, certain references to certain Nazis and certain camps. But for me, it's an incredibly powerful, important, significant film that tells you what happened in the Holocaust and what happened at Auschwitz. And actually, partly through our partners at A24, who are co-financiers and distributors of the film, A24 have a very good reputation with young audiences. So we know, for example, in America, that a lot of younger people are watching it, going to the cinema, because it's actually an A24 film. So I feel very encouraged that people are learning about the Holocaust, because certainly it seems at the moment that Holocaust education is something we need to make sure this continuing on is even more profoundly understood.
What about the criticism? It was directed more actually at that film, One Life, about Nicholas Winton, but some of it was directed at Zone of Interest, which is that what's missing from this film, brackets, it's missing from a lot of Holocaust films, is Jews.
Yeah.
I mean, there is perhaps a Jewish maid in the Hearst household. We're not completely sure about that. But otherwise, because the killing is unseen, very much heard, as you'll need to, but unseen, that once again, we're in a Holocaust film where there aren't Jews to be seen.
I understand that criticism, but I don't agree with that. I mean, I think there'd be many, many great films with Jews about the Holocaust. And what John's intention was, and I understand this, was how does he wants to make a film about the Holocaust. How does he bring originality to that subject? And how does he do it in a way which you've not seen before? And I think that was his intention. And he started out about 10 years ago, deciding he wanted to make a film about the Holocaust, and took quite a while to locate the way he was going to do it, which, you know, as we know now, was to focus on the Hoss family and that house. And I think what he's been able to do, and it's actually part of its brilliance rather than negative, is he's found an entirely original way of telling a story about the Holocaust. And so for me, I focus on that rather than that absence, because in many ways, the Jews, they're in every frame. You hear them, you feel them, you suffer with them. In every frame almost, because the family don't care about them and ignore them and don't see them as humans. So I think they're there in every moment of the film, and that's part of its horror. Just because you don't see them, I don't think they're not there. And I think he should be, one of the great things about the film, and why I think why it's so brilliant and has been so recognized this week and at other times, is because he sounds such a, found such an original way of making a film about a subject on which there have been many films.
One of the sort of points of, I think you said, you kind of sit and you watch it and your stomach is in a knot because of those moments where obviously the barbarity of what is going on hits the pastoral life that they are living. And I wonder what, you know, to you is sort of the height of this, the if we can say it without spoiling it for anyone who hasn't watched it, what is the scene that you would, because I can think of many of them, but I'm wondering what you would sort of mark as that kind of moment.
Yeah, I think I find it hard to identify one. The film first came to me as something to potentially be a financier on, with that there are real hot sort of photographs of the real family in the garden, and they're almost like holiday snaps. Interestingly, every one of those is facing away from the camp wall, so you never see that wall in the background. But they're sort of, you know, a family enjoying themselves in the garden. And really, I knew personally I wanted to be involved in this film from that moment on, because I'd not seen that before. I've relatively well studied on the Holocaust, but I'd not seen all this before. So that for me was like the moment of, right, I'm in. And, you know, and the person I work with on film and finances films with is Len Blavatnik, Sir Len Blavatnik. And I showed him those photos as well, and we were both in. So I think the scenes in the garden are very, very important to me because, you know, as you see in the film, the sort of the fact they feel they've made this paradise where the wall, the back wall and the side wall is Auschwitz and the chimney's in the background. And it's really the case, by the way. You know, the film was filmed about 200 meters from the real Hoss house. And when you look over the fence of the real Hoss house, one of the walls is one of those walls of Auschwitz with, you know, the curled edge with where they'd have had the electric wire. People lived there. People, remarkably, someone still lives there. Wow. So the garden's very important to me. I think that scene with Hedwig where she's trying on the coat is pretty, pretty terrifying.
We understand where the coat is coming from, right?
Yeah. And I mean, everyone will take the minute. I find the scene, the bureaucratic normalization that you see in that scene with the camp commandants talking about what is going to happen, I find personally particularly frightening, because it also gives you a sense of scale and intent. But different people will take different things. I think Sandra Hüller's performance is truly extraordinary. Christian Friedler, I think, has been slightly overlooked, actually. I mean, the film would not work if Christian was not as good as he is. And Sandra deservedly has had a lot of plaudits, but I think Christian deserves them too. I find that scene in the bedroom where she's asking for chocolates and they're laughing and giggling about going on a spa holiday. I mean, there's so many.
It's quite true when you said that this is going to be remembered, because I've only seen it once. I saw it 3 or 4 months ago, and yet every scene you've mentioned, I would have mentioned them too. I remember them. It's absolutely sears me. And above all, and you did mention it, is the sound. The sound is the thing that haunts you, I think, for forever. It sounds like the gates of hell have been opened up. Can we move to a previous bit of your career, Danny, which is you are the former director of television at the BBC, as Jonit said.
Yeah.
And you have been pretty outspoken since leaving, I mean, especially in recent months, about the BBC and its coverage of the events since October the 7th. What is it getting wrong?
Yeah. So I actually not criticized, I left the BBC over 6 years ago. I had not criticized it in any forum before 7th of October. And the reason I hadn't was I've been in there myself, and I know you can feel like it's coming from all sides. And it can actually be one of the most frustrating things can be when someone who's been in there criticizes you because you feel they should know how it's not easy. But the BBC's response to 7th October changed that for me. And I felt I had no choice really. And, you know, I love the BBC. And so you could argue it's painful, but it's to me, ultimately, that's not really relevant when the stakes are so high as they are here. I think the question I keep, well, first of all, I wrote something on 8th of October about the refusal to use the words terrorist when we've seen them use terrorist attack and terrorist in other places. So I think they got off to a very bad start. And I think that was very misjudged and offensive because we know they've used it in other contexts and they kind of doubled down. And as the BBC does, they dig in their heels and then won't move. I think the thing that keeps coming back to me is every large organization makes errors. I will have made errors there. Everyone does it. I think you have to ask yourself, when the errors keep coming, when they're one after the other, what does that tell you? Does it tell you it's just a sequence of bad luck, or is there more to it? And in my view, it reveals institutional bias, anti-Israel bias, and in some cases, as we've seen, I think some of the areas like BBC Arabic, racism against Jews. And that's my view. And I, you know, state it very clearly. I think it's shared by a lot of the Jewish community in the UK. Not everyone, of course. But I think that sense that the errors keep coming, which makes them more than errors, is a problem. And I don't believe they take anti-Jewish racism as seriously as they take other forms of racism, because I don't think this would keep happening if they did. I think the other thing that's really noticeable to me is you keep getting, when there are problems, the press statements are the same. We take issues like this very seriously. You know, you get the same line over and over again. The BBC takes this very seriously. We won't comment on individual cases, all of those kinds of things. I don't think fundamentally the management of the senior management of the BBC, I think they're more concerned with managing a crisis than rooting out racism against Jews at the BBC. Mm-hmm. And I've been there myself, where you feel like in the middle of crisis there and you want to get through it. And I think that the impulse and the reactive impulse to defend the BBC and get through a crisis is actually what they're doing rather than dealing with the problem. And frankly, I think the problems continue in BBC News. I think there are a lot of continuing problems of bias and presentation. It's been interesting being in the US for a few days. The reporting is just so different. I can't tell you how different it is. In terms of coverage, what you see, context, lack of emotive language in how it's reported here. It's actually been a relief in some ways to be away from coverage, which feels very emotive, and often taking sides in a way which I don't think is appropriate.
You've been writing about this for a while. I assume you've had conversations with people who were your former employers or employees or people who were your friends. Do you see some sort of improvement? I mean, it's been 5 months or not
at all? I don't care, actually, because I actually think it's just more stupid of them than anything else. No one in a senior position at the BBC has reached out to me since I wrote that first article on 8th of October. And I actually, more than anything, I think it's just stupid, because they probably should have made an effort to try and help me understand their perspective. Mm-hmm. Where I have heard from is many, many, many Jewish employees of the BBC who are deeply hurt, angry. They feel the anti-Semitism and the anti-Israel bias in the building. That's people in news and also in the content division, you know, the sport content division and elsewhere. They feel that bias. They feel unhappy, and they don't know what to do about it. And they feel that if they spoke out, they would lose their jobs. So I've heard horrendous stories about what people are experiencing, the Jewish employees in the BBC. Horrendous. But the people involved don't feel they're able to tell those stories without risking either isolation or being told you've spoken to the press or spoken to someone who's going to write something about it, and therefore you have to leave.
When you say horrendous stories, Danny, what are you hearing?
Instances of anti-Semitism, ways of cutting news stories which aren't balanced, direction in that sense. I think, and as I said, it's not just news. You know, I was absolutely appalled that the BBC, there was an unrepentant anti-Semite on The Apprentice. Now, it's complex. The show was already recorded. What wasn't recorded was the You're Fired show, which is, you know, the spin-off show. my understanding, and I've heard it confirmed by a number of people, is that they made two recordings of that program, one with the anti-Semite in and one without, to decide which one they'd use. Now, in the end, under pressure, they used the other one. But what on earth is going on? If that person had been, you know, racist against black people or Muslim people or any other community, would they have seriously recorded two versions to decide which would be the one to use? So I things like that I find very, very troubling. Mm. And people keep coming to me, you know, BBC employees keep coming to me, Jewish ones, to express how unhappy they are and the management don't get it. Some of them tell me that, you know, non-Jewish senior managers are telling them what is and isn't anti-Semitism. I don't believe that a senior manager would tell a Muslim person or a black person what is or isn't racism against them. So that, you know, it's that thing that we hear a number of times, that the racism against Jews is being treated differently to racism against other types of people. And that's why I felt obliged to speak out.
You know, we met for the first time in 2014. I think you hold the credit for being the only person I interviewed that became my friend after the interview.
Wow. Really? Really? Wow.
I think so. And I'm bringing this up because
let's see how she feels after this interview, Danny.
Yeah.
It's not over yet.
No, that's true, actually. Yeah, I'll let you know also afterwards. Yeah.
It's interesting. I'm bringing this up because I asked you then, you were the director of the BBC, and I asked you then, and you had said that you have never felt so uncomfortable being a Jew in the UK as you do now. That was 2014. Yeah. It was right after Operation Protective Edge.
Yeah.
And I wonder, I mean, little did we know, both of us, you know, that we'd be sitting here and looking at those days as sort of a distant, unthreatening, I assume, unthreatening.
Yeah, you know, listen, it's a very distressing time for many, many British Jews. I mean, I you know, in an ironic way, and I won't be alone in this, and my wife says too, we get messages from friends in Israel, I think probably some from you, Yoni, and lots of relatives in Israel, asking if we're okay in London. And, you know, in a way, it seems ridiculous compared to the, you know, what Israel and the people of Israel have been going through, the suffering and the ongoing suffering and the war. But that gives a reflection of, I think, what it's like. And I think it's the way it seems to have invaded every area of public life. I think anti-Semitism has become permissible in a way it wasn't before October the 7th. It was there, but it's become permissible. Jonathan, I think you wrote something quite early on around, it's like a flare has gone up. And we can see all this anti-Semitism that was there that we couldn't see before. I hope I'm not butchering what you said. And I don't know if I can unsee it now. I mean, I thought a lot about what you said there. And now that flare's gone up and I can see it. I don't know how I unsee it in the future. And I think that's probably going to be quite a big mental adjustment for us. But, you know, I don't know, just this morning I've received, someone sent me something about the experience of Nottingham University students and a new BDS motion there, and the student union body doesn't think anti-Semitism is a priority. I heard from a friend who was in a restaurant last night where people on the next table were just being openly anti-Semitic as well as anti-Israel. I think it's suffusing our daily lives in a way that none of us could have expected. And feels horrifying. I don't know what other Jews feel. I feel my social world's got smaller since October the 7th. There's some people I don't want to have the conversation with because I'm fearful of what they're going to say and it would be irretrievable. And so I think, as well as I think it's bringing us all together closer as a Jewish community as a result, but it's also, I think it's making our worlds feel smaller. Certainly I feel that. Again, I really don't want to compare it to what people in Israel have been through and continue to go through and the events of October the 7th and 8th and the ongoing suffering of the hostages. But I've never felt like this in my lifetime. And I've started to hear people talk about whether they should stay or not. You know, I've started to hear those conversations, which, you know, it's quite discombobulating, isn't it? Like, you know, you sometimes have this kind of cognitive dissonance around it. I think we probably all felt it with the Claudine Gay moment in Congress with the university leaders said. But there've been many moments of that kind of cognitive dissonance where you could, oh my God, is that happening now? Is that really happening in 2024? So yeah, mm-hmm. I think it's hard, and I think we have to show resilience, stick together as a community, help others who aren't in the community understand what it's like. And I think we need a lot of support from government and institutions to ensure that things don't get worse for the Jewish community.
Danny Cohen, there in Los Angeles with some sobering thoughts on what should have been a very joyful week for you, but in the end has ended up being quite a tricky week one way or the other, what with the speech and everything else.
Yeah, I mean, I think big picture is we are honoured and thrilled to win Academy Awards. The film, as I say, is remarkable. I think that's what's going to be remembered in the long term, not that speech. And, you know, we're extremely proud of the film and, you know, there's been a bump in the road here, but I don't think it takes away for us the remarkable film and the impact it can have on Holocaust education, which was certainly, you know, the purpose for Len Blavatnik and I.
Danny, thank you so much. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for coming on Unholy.
Thank you. Lovely to speak to you.
It was so interesting talking to Danny. That part about it, he said the world is becoming smaller, is something that I, you know, that stays with me because of that, right? That you don't want to have these discussions with some of the people that you know because you're afraid what they're going to say to you. You know, all that kind of those feelings. It was really interesting. And of course, his strong disagreement with Jonathan Glazer himself and his thoughts about the BBC, you know, all of that was really interesting to me.
Yeah, I thought it was brave of him, actually, given, you know, we've got a film to promote. He didn't just give us a straight bat. He blatantly disagreed with the person he's been working with, vehemently so, and good for him in being so vocal on that. On the BBC, I didn't want to push back because I wanted to let him sort of put his case. We didn't have anyone there from the BBC to defend the organization. What they would say is, yes, they get criticized massively by supporters of Israel. They also get criticized massively by pro-Palestinian voices. And they would say, that means we're probably getting it just about right. It could actually mean they're getting it doubly wrong. When you say you're getting attacked by both sides, it doesn't always mean you're right. But there will be plenty of people who say the BBC, like he said, actually, for having been on the inside, it's an impossible job and people are always coming after you. I don't detract at all from his criticisms, but I did want to make that point that the BBC does say it gets heat from both sides and defends itself vigorously. And I'm a big defender of the BBC in general, and I think it does a vital job. But obviously, Danny makes a very, for him, he feels very, very strongly.
You know, we have to relax from all this conversation about Israel and Gaza, and the way to do that, I think, would to maybe travel in time a little bit. I think this is our first show since October 7th that we're allowing ourselves to do a little bit of culture, of course, that has to do with our main story arc of Israel and Judaism. But still, I think this goes into a new book that we wanted to talk about that tells a very interesting and little known story.
A new book called Melting Point has caused a bit of a sensation in literary circles here in London and beyond. One reader of the book, reviewer of the book, described it as meticulously researched and elegantly constructed. This is an inventive telling of an inventive, even outlandish scheme. The person who said those words was actually me, in a quote for Melting Point by Rachel Cockrell. And we're delighted to say Rachel is a guest on Unholy right now. So welcome, Rachel.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rachel, we're so glad to have you on. So this book, it's really unusual, and we're going to get onto how it's unusual in terms of its form, because it's written in a very striking way. It's called Melting Point, subtitle Family, Memory, and the Search for a Promised Land. For our purposes, there's very few places where you can really geek out on early Zionist history, but Unholy is one of them. So you've come to the right place. The book tells the story partly of one of what I would call a sort of alternative Zion, alternative Jewish homelands. People know about Uganda and Madagascar. Even Australia was talked about. But Galveston, Texas is at the center of your story. And I want you to clarify for us, because you're going to tell us about this plan, whether the plan was really to make Galveston, of all places in Texas, a genuine sort of Jewish state, Jewish homeland, literally like Israel would turn out to be. Or what? What exactly was this plan? And then we'll talk about how you and your family and so on were connected to it.
Sure. Yeah. Well, the Galveston plan, as it was called, really started, its roots are in Zionism. You know, the Zionists were looking to sort of, you know, acquire Palestine, or at least acquire permission to colonize Palestine. And there was a huge and dramatic split in the Zionist movement in the early 1900s. Some of the Zionists thought, as they said, Palestine's gates are going to remain closed to the Jews for many years or many decades to come. Let's look for a temporary alternative promised land. This sort of rival movement to the Zionist movement was called the Jewish Territorial Organization. Not the most catchy name, and that may be partly why they haven't really made it into the history books. But at the time, you know, it was in all the, on all the sort of front pages, in all the headlines, Zionism splits. The sort of motto of the Jewish Territorial Organization was, if we cannot get the Holy Land, we can make another land holy. And they scoured the earth for an alternative to Palestine. They approached governments in Australia and Canada and Mexico and Paraguay and many other places. And all these plans fell through for one reason or another, usually because the government in that country, for example, Australia, said a Jewish colony in Australia is quite out of the question. The American Jews then sort of, they caught wind of what was going on, and they said to the leader of the Jewish Territorial Organization, why don't we collaborate? There are too many Jews in New York. Why don't we bypass New York altogether and go to Texas? And the leader of this movement, Israel Zangwill, who I'm sure we'll talk about, said, I don't want to do that. I'd rather buy a American state, a Southern American state. He said, you know, that would be much better for me. You know, America is a huge continent. Can't the Jews have one state? To which the answer was no. So really, Galveston was never going to be a sort of Jewish colony. The Jews, when they got there, had to immediately disperse. They weren't allowed to sort of colonize or congregate. They were sort of put on a train that day, the day they landed or the day after, to somewhere in the American West.
How does your family, Rachel, come into this? Because you started out as actually writing a family memoir. So tie us into that, how does this tie into this Zionist story?
Yeah, my great-grandfather was called David Jochelman, and he was an early Zionist. And when Zionism split, he and others sort of stood up and stormed out of the Zionist Congress. And I didn't know any of this. So he sort of joined this rival group and then was sort of instrumental in the Galveston movement. My family had always sort of, if they had ever mentioned him at all, which was rarely, they said, David Jochelman was somehow involved in stocks and shares. The conversation never went any further than that. If we talked about my family, it was much more often about David Jochelman's daughter, my grandmother, Granny Fanny, she was called, who was a real character, so much so that, you know, in the decades since she's died, we still talk about her all the time. But no attention was really paid to her father, my great-grandfather. I wanted to write about Granny Fanny, but I was curious how my family came to England. I knew that Granny Fanny arrived in England as a child, speaking only Russian. And so I read a bit about David Jochelman, and I kept reading everywhere. Dr. Jochelman was instrumental in the Galveston movement. I didn't really know what any of that meant, but the more I found out, the more sort of captivated I became.
And the Galveston movement, it's such a fascinating idea. As you say, there was all these Jews cramming into New York. People were worried that there would be, I presume they were partly worried about anti-Semitism, that people would dislike all these, this sort of teeming city of Jews. We need to spread them around the country. Meanwhile, there's Israel Zangwill, who, you know, you mentioned British, you know, one of the most, you say at the time, he was one of perhaps the most famous Jew in the world. Still barely, I mean, he is barely remembered here. In the biggest Jewish school in this country, JFS, that one of the houses is called Zangwill. And people remember, you know, children of the ghetto and so on. But it is, he's almost forgotten. But he, it seems, was very just eventually persuaded that while we're waiting for a land of refuge, I'm just looking, reading the book now, we can at least, you know, we'll sidetrack the cherished project of finding a separate land of refuge and send people to Galveston, there to the rest of the Southwest. It was news to me, all of that. Just, but these characters who appear in the book, you paint wonderful portraits of them from the writings of the time. Theodore Herzl is there with this sort of majestic look. But tell us a little bit about this figure of Israel Zangwill and why, you know, why he leaps off the history books for you.
Yeah, I mean, I would even question whether he leaps off the history books because really I didn't find a huge amount about him in the history books. I went straight to sort of old memoirs and letters and diaries about him, all these amazing sort of anecdotes about him. Zangwill As you said, Yonit, I tried to write a family memoir, and this so-called family memoir ended up sort of being taken over by Israel Zangwill, this long-forgotten novelist who bears no relation to me. I think part of the reason he is long-forgotten is that he more or less abandoned his literary career for the sake of Zionism. He met Theodor Herzl in the late 1890s and was so captivated by Herzl's charm and charisma. He's almost slightly in love with him, that he allowed himself to be swept up in the Zionist movement. And then subsequently in the territorialist movement, as it was called, this sort of search for an alternative. And he sort of neglected his literary career, which is why he is not better known today. But I almost fell in love with him. He was apparently a totally shambolic figure, always very badly dressed, sort of straggling hair, things falling out of his pockets, stumbling around London, like always about to get run over by a horse-drawn carriage. And one person said, if he was ignorant, you would throw him out of doors for his looks. As it is, you draw near and listen. He just had this sort of encyclopedic mind. So he was so sort of funny and clever. This phrase Zangwillism came into the English vocabulary, which was a word for these phrases that he would coin. He was so original, never used cliches, that he would sort of make up these phrases. So people would say, oh, what a wonderful Zangwillism that is. And really his legacy is the phrase Melting Pot. He wrote a play in 1908 called The Melting Pot, which caused a storm in America and sort of created this national discourse. Theodore Roosevelt was in the audience on the first night and led the standing ovation. And people said, is this the great American play? Has this English playwright or this Jewish playwright put his finger on something which we've been thinking about for all these years, which is the idea of America as the melting pot? Has this Englishman finally done it?
I want to talk about the way that you write this. And we should tell our listeners who haven't read the book, there's not a word of yours in it. It's tell us about the form and how you thought of it and, you know, how you wrote it, actually.
Yeah. The whole book is formed of interwoven eyewitness accounts. Some people have called it an experimental book, but I think if I heard that someone had written an experimental Jewish history / family memoir, I would run a mile.
Not the best sell.
sounds awful. and really, I've never really got on with experimental books. You think of experimental books and you think of books with a lot of white space, perhaps some sort of poetry, not much plot. But really, this is a book really driven by the characters and driven by the plot. And I hope people read it almost like a novel. I originally had my own sort of voice in there, just sort of intervening before and after each quotation. And I found myself getting annoyed at my own interventions because, you know, I wasn't at the first Zionist Congress. I wasn't at Zangwill's, you know, premiere of The Melting Pot in 1908. Whereas I think some Jewish family memoirs, the author is a character and they're sort of going on this journey. I wasn't really. Mm-hmm. So I started taking my own voice out. And I noticed that when I did that, sometimes if I juxtaposed two sources or two, you know, eyewitness accounts, two tellings of the same event, something interesting would happen, which was these sort of long dead voices would come alive and would almost seem to be in conversation with each other. They would either be arguing with each other or be sort of giving a 360 degree view of a certain scene, you know, the first Zionist Congress, for example. There were so many journalists there and they all wrote about it either in memoirs or in articles at the time. So it felt kind of like teleporting to the beginning of the 20th century and not having that 21st century voice butting in every so often to say how awful or how wonderful or sort of paraphrasing some quotation. It just did something for me. It took me back in time, and I hope it takes the reader back in time as well.
It completely does, and I think nonfiction will be different as a result. I mean, that's a big claim, but I think people will write books now, they'll try and copy this as a style. It requires extraordinary research. I mean, you've had to get 100 accounts of quite obscure events. But the juxtaposing, as you say, means that you hear the story unfolded. But, I mean, there are points of odd sort of interest in it, because in the margin, you say where things came from. And I was very struck that, just for example, I was looking at it again last night, you have an account of the marriage of Israel Zangwill with his, interestingly, non-Jewish wife. And you note, actually, some of these big Zionists did marry Jewish men who married women who weren't Jewish. But you have notes in the margin, and I see that an account of that marriage is in the Yorkshire Post or the Aberdeen Press and Journal. And you think, okay, this man was really a very big star, you know, if a Jewish marriage, as it were, is being reported there. So all kinds of points of interest. Just on that point about the sort of marital choices, including ones that were made in your own family, it means that you're from the branch of the family that is no longer Jewish. And so I was left wondering how you would describe your own identity now, maybe particularly after having written this book.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot recently. People have been asking me, do you feel more Jewish now than you did 5 years ago, which was when I started the book? And I think maybe once I sort of said yes, but now I've been thinking about it more. And I think I actually don't feel more Jewish, but I know so much more about what I don't have and what I didn't have growing up and all the things that aren't in my head. I've been to visit my sort of distant relatives who live in Israel, and, you know, that there are kids my age, and they, you know, I had Passover with them, and they were, you know, singing in Hebrew and, you know, laughing about certain parts of the Passover ceremony. They just have all this sort of ritual and history in their heads, which I don't have. Really, I grew up with almost no Judaism in my life. My dad celebrated Passover as a child because his mother did it. But he didn't pass that on to his children. My grandmother spoke Russian and possibly a bit of Yiddish, didn't pass that on to her children, who didn't, you know, my dad didn't then pass it on to me. Really, the only Jewish thing that I have left is gefilte fish balls and matzo balls, which, you know, my legacy from my dad. But I don't know if, yeah, they're not my favorite foods on earth.
I wonder, since it did start out as a family memoir, and I kind of love that you start, that's where you start your research, but it turns into this huge, you know, forgotten tale of Zionism. Did you discover something about, you know, what are the things that you discovered about your family that surprised you?
The biggest thing I discovered was that Zangwill is the reason I exist. My great-grandfather was sort of Zangwill's second in command. Zangwill was the leader of the Galveston movement. He lived in London. My great-grandfather lived in Ukraine and sort of ran the Russian side of things. When World War I broke out, Zangwill said to my great-grandfather, "Your destiny belongs to England. You must now move here, bring your wife and children here. Their future is English." My great-grandfather had been planning to move to America, and I don't know how spontaneous the decision was, whether in the sort of chaos of World War I breaking out, it was just by chance, or whether he gave it a lot of thought and decided that his future really did belong to England. But he followed Zangwill's advice and Zangwill's wish, and he moved to England with his wife and his two daughters, including my grandmother. And finding those letters in archives that sort of are these pieces of paper that caused my existence was really quite something.
And we should say all these Russian Jews were the focus of attention because they were seen as being imperiled at the time because pogroms and so on, that life was pretty hard for Russian Jews. That was the focus at the time that your great-grandfather was active.
It was, yeah. And actually, sometimes when I tell people that my great-grandfather was saving Jews and bringing them to Texas, they think, oh, was it in the 1930s? And really, I don't think it's sort of common knowledge that, you know, the pogroms in Russia were the cause for many Russian Jews to sort of turn their eyes to America.
And this may be our last one, but Galveston itself, what happened to that? I mean, is there any residual mark, any traces of this scheme there in Galveston, Texas?
There is, yeah. There is a Galveston synagogue with a plaque outside it saying, you know, the Galveston movement brought 10,000 Russian Jews to America through this kind of portal of Galveston. I met the rabbi of Galveston when I was there, and we had fish tacos on the beach with the sound of crashing waves behind us. I mean, really, it's not a hugely Jewish place because there was such a fear of creating a Jewish colony in Galveston that I think almost none of the Galveston immigrants were allowed to stay there. You know, it was within 24 hours, they were sort of out of there. But I mean, I felt like I was making a pilgrimage when I went there. I was walking through the streets of Galveston with sort of tears in my eyes. I knew that my great grandfather had visited more than 100 years before. And, you know, the Houston Daily Press had written, Dr. Jockelman is here all the way from Ukraine. Maybe I was sort of following in his footsteps in a way.
Well, the book is Melting Point by Rachel Cockrell. As I say, rave reviews here. And thanks so much for coming on Unholy.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Rachel.
I was very glad she said what she said about experimental nonfiction. I think I too would have had that kind of reaction and did wonder about this book before I opened it. But it really is a very, very fresh way of telling what is a fascinating story. I think that move, so-called territorialism, she's right. It has been forgotten. It's seen as sort of it's a equivalent of a pub quiz question. What were the other Jewish homelands? But it goes to what was a deep longing for a refuge which predated the Holocaust. And I think that's very important in all the arguments now, you know, people going on about settler colonialism and everything. Yes, they did use the vocabulary of colonies and so on, but it was born of an amazing degree of prescience by the likes of Israel Zangwill. She also describes Vladimir Jabotinsky in very dramatic terms in the book, and her great-grandfather, who understood decades before the rest of the world would, that Jews were in a state of existential peril. Yes, the threat was to Russian Jews, but they understood that time was ticking. Jews had to find somewhere they could protect themselves. And so it's an extremely poignant story because you know that, yes, there were these efforts at the margins, but basically they did not get the Jews of Europe to a place of safety in time. And that's what hangs over the book and is resonant to all the conversations we've been having in this week's episode, but also that we're having all throughout this period.
And if only their plans could have happened faster, we would have been living in a very different world. You're so right about that. To me, you know, I was listening to Rachel tell the story of early Zionism and the way it's intertwined in her family story. I could not think of that opening scene in Angels in America, Tony Kushner's masterpiece, where the rabbi, which is, by the way, played by Meryl Streep, is saying at the funeral of the grandmother, you know, I'm paraphrasing this, but she says, or he says rather, journeys like hers from the shtetl to America no longer exist, but they live inside us. And it's kind of the same way. It lives inside of Rachel and her family story. I mean, it's really an extraordinary story. We have some awards to dole out, and we should do it quite briefly. We've been running a little bit long, so I will begin with the Chutzpah Award of the Week. I think can only go. My only candidate would be the Chief Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef, who was threatening, this is an official role, by the way, he was threatening under his official title that if the government does indeed conscript ultra-Orthodox, and we've been talking about this a lot, about the bill that needs to be written and presented to the Knesset. If that indeed happens, there will be a massive Haredi exodus from Israel, essentially saying we will leave the country if you try to force us to enlist. Do I need to explain why this is chutzpah? Since then, he has backtracked this a little bit, but it's just something that, you know, it exacerbates the already open wound in Israeli society, definitely after 5 months of war, that this conversation has been going on in the way that it has. The rabbis, generally speaking, have not been, let's say, cooperating with the idea of somehow having some sort of service for the ultra-Orthodox.
Yeah, if you make us defend the country, we'll leave it. It is... It is a chutzpah nominee with great prospects for success. Just a mention before we get to our mensch, the father of one of the hostages, Robbie Chen, whose son Itai Chen was declared dead this week, said that Joe Biden had phoned to comfort the family. He said he shared our grief, strengthened us, gave us the phone number of his personal assistant, and spoke to us like a father to his sons. Robbie Chen added, Netanyahu did not call. So a mention to Joe Biden for making that phone call. I thought of an alternative and worthy winner for our mention of the week would be something very different, though, which is the archaeologists, a team of scientists, rather, in Iran have found what they believe is the world's oldest known lipstick that was worn up to 5,000 years ago in what is now southern Iran. Deep red lip paint contained in a stone vial was found in an ancient graveyard site about 20 years ago. It took researchers a while to identify it. They now have done that. Why is that menchworthy? It's because Iran, remember, is a place that has the guidance patrols. They're known more commonly as the morality police. Those people who go around to enforce what they call Islamic dress code, making sure women are dressed sort of modestly, hijab, and also back in the day, particularly at the time of the Iranian Revolution, would prevent Iranian women wearing makeup. It turns out that Iranian women, Persian women, have been wearing makeup for thousands of years, long before there was any Islam, before Islam even existed in Iran or anywhere else. And so that discovery of the world's oldest lipstick in Iran, 5,000 years old, a reminder that the morality police come and they go, but some things endure and outlive them.
I love that story. I love the thought that we think we're so different, right? It's been thousands of years since we have our iPhones, but women like lipstick, even if it was 5,000 years ago. I remember we talked on this show, one of our first episodes, about a lice comb that was found in an archaeological site that was 3,000 years old. You're like, I'm sitting with the same mother 3,000 years ago trying to get this lice out of their children's hair. Anyway, beautiful story. And we will wrap up our show, and we will say our thank yous to Guy Glaser, Omer Primat, and Omri Barak. And we will meet next week, Jonathan.
See you then, Yonit.